of course, for over a decade, he was Mr. Saturday Night, guaranteed ratings winner, and he was one of the most bankable stars in the UK. He was today's equivalent to Anton Deck. But then an addiction to drink and drugs, the death of a man at his Essex home in 2001, led to his world collapsing around him. And his life, well, it changed forever. Have a listen to this interview if you did miss it last night and pick up the phone, 08459 555 678. He began by telling me what it was like at the height of his fame.
I don't think you really take it in, you know, because it becomes such a big machine. And you're working at it all the time, and it's so full on that you can't sit there and think there's 18 million people watching this. You know, you work to the studio audience, it'd be pretty much the same size as this. And you know, my drug of choice actually is my work. And so, you know, that I was totally addicted to that. I knew what I wanted to do when I was a kid. I had no idea I was going to do it. It came from the docks, and my Irish mum, and a lot of time was brought up in Mayo and stuff like that. And then, you know, so it was enough for me just to get up there and do it. And that, it was very important to me. And I've got a lot of time for people. I've always actually really, really genuinely liked people. There's a lot of people in the business that are very good at what they do, but they don't actually like people. They're not actually mad about people themselves, you know. They don't want this life where they can be up there on stage and then have nothing to do. You know, that should be isolated to itself. And I've never been like that. So I was always very outgoing. So it was very important how people reacted to me, how they felt about me, and how they perceived me, and how they saw me. And I never manufactured at any time how I was, you know. I didn't put a face on that suited them. So, you know, for that reason, I was very open. I didn't mind my vulnerability being shown on stage.
But were you enjoying it?
Yeah, I loved it.
When you look back on it, I guess from having the perspective of having lost it, right?
Yeah.
Now, clearly, from the story that I now know about you, drink, drugs, addiction, driven character, I'm wondering when I see that, what was the real Michael Barrymore? You know,
that's the real one. He's the real one. That's the real one you're seeing there. There was no real separation, and I think a lot of the time, because I mix with people rather than people in show business, that people would go, "Oh, you're Michael Barrymore." I go, "So what does that mean?" I never really took it seriously. I think that was probably, you know, the making of me and my downfall as well. You know, because I didn't see what the problem was. I didn't take on board just how big it was. Ever. Still don't, actually. I still don't. I still get bemused by I get humbled by people, how they are with me. And I've had this relationship with the public for a long, long time. And even through all the worst times as well.
In terms of the drinking, mm-hmm. When did you spot you had a problem? Was it from early on?
No, I didn't drink or get into any drugs, or I didn't even smoke cigarettes till I was about 30 something. You know, I could have got away with it, I suppose, but you know, it all came. Well, success breeds its own unemployment, so you're getting paid a lot more money to do a lot less, and you know, so you've got all this time, and I suddenly thought, who am I? And then I found the drink and stuff and tried to fill all the gaps with that.
But what do you mean by that? You suddenly thought, who were you because of the success? What do you mean?
Well, because I'd given no time to actually discover who I was, to find out who I was. I spent, like, from a kid, I made my mates laugh at school. I did that, and then it became a living. And then I went from there and became successful. And the more I was outrageous and did things and broke the rules, the more successful it got. And so it was always, I was always happy enough to, if I got enough money out of it. As a kid, I thought if I get £100 a week to do what I do, I'd be very, really happy, but I didn't allow for inflation and stuff like that, obviously. But I mean, you know, well, a little bit. But I mean, you know, I never actually took it seriously.
And the drink was filling what gap, Michael?
Well, at first I thought it was because I was gay. I thought that was the problem.
And you must have known from pretty early on.
No, I didn't. I was happily married. I was very happily married, and it wasn't something that really bothered me, to be quite honest. And you know, it was the odd times when I thought, oh, I don't, you know, when you get occasions and then the drink, you know, leads to things, and you think, oh, I don't know how to deal with this. And then it just came upon me, you know. It really did.
Were you drinking after shows?
I had a really golden rule. It's Cheryl. I know it probably looked like I did, but I never took anything before I worked. That was my golden rule.
But a little bit after?
Oh, yeah, I went for it then.
What does that mean?
The minute in my dressing room, the wine would be there, and I'd knock that back. And it was, I never actually enjoyed drink. It was for the effect, just to change the way I felt. So I wasn't...
But you just come out of a studio audience like this...
Yeah.
..with people absolutely adoring you.
Yeah.
So why do you need drink? You're on a high. You're sitting in a dressing room and everybody thought you were God.
Yeah, because once the drug had worn off, it's wanting to keep the... No drug can replace the adrenaline you get from a live performance and working to an audience. No, there isn't a drug in the world or an amount of drink. So I was trying to replace that, and I didn't want the high to come down from where I was. But it wasn't enough. The come down is so much of the adrenaline.
Can you describe the come down when you go back into the dressing room?
It's just a complete drop of, you know, you're buzzing and buzzing and buzzing just from working to the audience, and especially the way I worked, where it's all improvisation, genuinely, you know, whatever happens on the night, you know, like if I was working here tonight, I'd just take the evening as it goes and I'd let it. And that's why my live performance used to get so much following, because it would just be for that crowd that night, you know. And you know, when you're working like 24/7, and my mind was entirely on my work the whole time. If that wasn't there, I used to dread going on holiday. I've been miserable in some of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, it's a sad thing to say.
It's really sad, isn't it?
It is sad. It's a terrible thing to say. But it's the truth.
So success brought you sadness?
Yeah, it did, because, on the one hand, I can't do without it. And on the other hand, it was slowly killing me anyway.
Well, it wasn't killing you.
Well, it wasn't killing me as such. I was doing that by taking the drink and the drugs. Nobody forced it down my throat. I did it. But you've got to remember that if you're an addict, and that people don't understand properly, really, what addiction is all about. You know, what it, you know, why, you go, what's wrong with you? You've got success, lots of money, the people adore you, you're loved, which I was, which I am, you know, my family and everything. And then why do you want to do this? It's called addiction.
So you had that aspect of your life, and you're a man of contrast, aren't you? In this, the public persona and perception, as it is of many performers,
yeah.
Which is, look at that, that man's happy, he's got everything in the world, and yet you have this reality. You're going back to the dressing room, and you're sad because you need that adrenaline, you need that buzz, and you're getting hooked on alcohol, and then.
Well, by the way, sorry, if I could have worked 18 hours a day in front of an audience, 18 hours, every day of the week, for every day of the year, I wouldn't need any drink or drugs. But that's impossible.
So you're only happy on stage?
So that makes it even sadder, yeah. I don't know anything else.
How come there was that amount of emptiness in your life? Because you had the lady we just saw, you had Cheryl in your life, and you loved her.
Yeah,
and she
absolutely.
Was right by your side.
Yeah.
So how come... That wasn't filling the emptiness. What was your relationship like?
Well, because what happened there was because I was a husband, a lover, a child. We lost a couple of kids when we first married, and I wanted to adopt, and she didn't. Because I remember coming away from the adoption society, and she said, "You're not doing this for me, are you?" I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I don't need children." Now, you know, there's the myth that every woman wants children. They don't. And I didn't answer because I thought, well, how can we have children? How can we adopt children if only 50% of us want it, 50% of the relationship? So I said no more, and so I became a husband, a lover, a child, and a career. And it was too much wrapped up in one person. Now, as much as that was the success of it, because all I had to do was get up and work. She was totally addicted to me.
She was your manager.
She was totally addicted to me.
And she was controlling you as well, wasn't
but
she? She chose your clothes.
She chose my clothes. I never once looked in a mirror and checked my clothes. I used to just put the clothes on for the show, stand there and go, yeah, that's all right, and then put the next one on for the next series and stuff like
that. So that we all know at home,
And so we know in the studio audience, before the show, Michael said to me, ask me anything you like, there's nothing off limits. And in that spirit, Michael, when you got married to Cheryl,
yeah,
had you any inkling you were gay?
No, I thought, do you want the theatrical answer or the truth?
I want the truth.
Yeah, right, OK. I thought that getting married would stop the feelings. Does that answer it? And it did for a long time. And then it came back and reared its head again, you know.
Were the feelings intense?
No.
When you got married? Were you finding more men than women attractive?
No, because I wasn't brave enough. I was brought up in the docks, you know. You don't put your hand up in Bermondsey, and it wasn't trendy like it is now. And so I think I got a problem. I might, you know, fancy the same sex. You just don't, it's just not on, you know. And a strong Catholic upbringing and stuff like that. I was going to be a priest. Oh, God, can you imagine? You know, it's... But it was a stage. I loved it. I mean, I loved being an altar boy. You got paid for doing weddings and stuff like that.
And so with...
Did a rosary every night.
With your wife, though, you had this secret in your head that you hoped that the homosexual feelings would go away.
Yeah, do you know what happened? Is because it got so successful, the work, all that, I didn't even think about it. So I think, in a way, I was throwing myself so much into my work. We were such a unit together. We, you know, and we had a great sex life as well. It's not as if there wasn't, you know, that as well. You know, we were very... It was working all the way around. And I think where success came, I just found it just too much that I couldn't cope anymore with... I was not the pressure. I mean, all this about the pressure about the business, you know, it wasn't pressure to me. I love what I do. I absolutely adore what I do.
Do you think she ever...
I still do. I've never lost the passion. Despite all the crap I've dealt with, to deal with, all the things that have happened, all the mistakes I've made, you know, I have to look at my part in things. It's not all... I can't go, oh, it's them, you know?
Well, let's...
I don't mean you, by the way. I'm talking about...
Let's move...
Two strangers sitting to the side of an audience. Oh, glad you're interested.
Let's... You want to be in this seat when we swap? Will you come here?
I love the way you got yourself facing the audience, and I'm like...
Can we talk about the night that I guess... Well, a massive night in your life, and a night that a young man died.
Yeah.
At your home. You've been out that night partying?
Yeah.
Why did you bring people back to your house, Michael?
Back to the same thing I was talking about earlier. I thought it was OK. You know, there's probably loads of people in this audience that have either had people back at their house that they didn't know who they were.
Not if you're a Saturday night TV superstar. You know you're vulnerable.
Yeah, but that's back to that. It's back to that. I didn't see that. I didn't see what the problem was. I was drunk. I was gone. And, you know, one guy said, oh, I'll be your security. I went, yeah, OK. And come back. And do you know what? I think deep down, if I was being really honest, and I'm comfortable enough here to be honest, not that I haven't been elsewhere, but sometimes, you know, with interviewers, you close up because you get the thing on, where's this going? I'm not, and I'll be honest and say that to you now.
I
think that sometimes, you know, it's a bit of the London boys done well, you know, come from nothing, no, you know, from family. And showing off.
And so...
And a bit, you know, it's the big house.
Michael.
The nice sound system.
Michael,
yeah.
What happened?
What happened?
Stuart Lubbock was found...
Oh, yeah.
...dead in your swimming pool.
So,
where were you?
So, I was in the house, and the others went out. They said, can I go in the pool? Can I swim in the pool? I said, it's halfway through being built. I put the... drew the top back. The switch is over there on the left. And that goes back to show the light up from underneath. Some of them went out to there. There were four girls there as well, which the press very conveniently leave out. And I went and had a joint with James, and I can't remember his name now, it doesn't matter. And then we went back out. He said, oh, do you want to go to the jacuzzi? I said, yeah, OK. Went out, and the other lot had been out earlier. And when we went outside, looked down, and I didn't even know Stuart's name at the time. It was just another member of the party, right? Looked down, and he's there floating in the pool, whether he's down or the top or whatever.
What did you do?
Our first thing I did was run back into the house and get Jonathan, who I knew was had a life-saving experience, and the other guy, Merrick, came with him. And James and Futures jumped in, because I can't swim, jumped in and pulled him up, and the other one jumped in as well. I didn't see that, but they jumped in to get him, and I went and get the other two. They came out, they started working on him. The other ones came around, I was starting to freak out, and then the girls started screaming when they saw he was just laying there. He wasn't moving much. And then James said to me, come away, there's nothing, no more you can do here. The ambulance has been called, they're working on him there, there's no more we can do.
So how it was reported?
Yeah.
Is that you ran away?
Not straight, I didn't run away. And first thing, they never report that, first thing I did was go and get help. But they choose not to report those things. They were working on him. I was standing there, and instead of going, no, I should stay here, I went with the lads down the bottom of the drive to their flat. As I went out, I didn't ring my PR agent, say. I've never had a PR agent. I don't employ the likes of Max Clifford or anything. I never have done. I had a PA, was my personal assistant. I rang Mike. I said, the guy's in the pool. He's on the side of the pool. The ambulance has been rang. If the police need me, I'm in James's place, which is at the bottom of the drive.
It didn't look good, you leaving the scene.
Absolutely not. No, it's one of the worst things I could have done. And when it gets reported, and the way it's been reported all over the years, as it has been done, it can't look right, can it? It can't look right at all. But that doesn't make me guilty of something that never happened in the first place. Never, they wanted it to fit the way they wanted it to fit instead of what the facts were.
This is the press you're talking about, national press.
Yeah. Always have done all the way along. As has been proven, now it's all starting to come out about various things, with the phone hacking. If they were phone hacking me, which they were at the time, which are about to apologise in a few weeks' time, for hacking my phone.
They've already settled with you.
They've settled with me. And
there's going to be an apology.
Yeah,
and wording's still to be agreed.
Yeah. But there's a point. If they were hacking my phone, which they were, they would know that I made no phone calls to anybody saying, oh, don't go there, don't say this to the police and don't say that. So why didn't they report that to the police? They choose not to give that information. They go on about, we do what we do because we want to bring, as journalists, we want to bring justice.
Well, look, as a journalist, I'm going to say this to you because I want people to be able to see your eyes and I want people to be able to hear it from you rather than how it's reported, right? You know that a lot of the studio and at home, you know when they're watching this interview what they will be asking themselves. They'll be saying, did he do it? How do you cope with that? And what do you say to them?
Well, absolutely not. No way. No way did I do it. And if I did, you know, I'd have put my hands up 10 years ago. Or 11 years, whatever it is now. I couldn't. I mean, you know, I haven't spoken about this properly like this, properly really at all, to be quite honest. And I do find it difficult to talk about, not because I'm guilty of anything, but because I didn't do anything. I did a stupid thing. I walked away from the scene. But I'd already gone in and got help to bring him out. Nothing happened to the guy there.
So then, Michael, you become, from becoming one of the most loved people in the country, a lot of people hate you and a lot of people are forming decisions about you and your front page news and the press are vicious about you.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on inside your head?
Well, a couple of times...
It destroyed you.
Yeah, a couple of times I thought, do you know what, I'd be better off out of this. Because, you know, I was banging the table saying, this isn't right, this isn't what's gone on, this isn't what's happened, I'm not guilty of anything. And, you know, the way it was reported as well, is a lot of people believe, they say, oh, well, that trial's over. There was no trial. There never has been a trial. But the way it was reported is as if there was a trial, and as if, because you're Michael Barrymore, you're afforded, you got off something. Well, you got away with something.
That's my point, that people watching this, that's exactly what some of them will be thinking. How do you live with that?
But who led them down that road? Who made them believe that? Who made them believe that?
What's your answer?
The press.
And why would they want to do that to you, Michael?
The police didn't help either, did they? Why didn't the police correct everything when they go along saying this is not what happened?
Well, the police can only arrest someone when they have reasonable grounds for suspicion, right?
Yeah, but a lot of people don't, with respect to a lot of people that do, a lot of people don't know the difference between arrested under suspicion of and being charged. And the reason I'm being charged with anything is there's nothing to charge me for. You have to have the evidence. There's no evidence.
And
there.
So when those front pages, and I remember seeing them, because remember that you...
One of them was, you are a murderer. How do you get round that? How do you think that made me feel?
Well, when you saw it, you tell me, how did you feel?
I completely destroyed. Twice I've been carted off to the hospital with overdoses over the last 10 years. Not recently. You know, I've got myself to a better place. I've got myself to a place where, you know, actually, you know, as the interview's gone on, when we was going through that bit just now, I'll tell you what I was feeling. I started to close in a bit, and then I started to break through again. You know, I'm just telling you how I feel as it's going along. Because these are, you know, when you've made people smile all your life, how do you show remorse? How do you show, or how do you apologise? One, for things you haven't done, and then when you have to say, well, hang about, there is your part of it.
And I guess if I'm brutally honest, how do you restore a reputation which maybe you can't restore because so much damage has been done?
Maybe it's damaged goods, maybe. Persona non grata.
And you thought of taking your own life, such was
there? But again, that was, you know, I did hang in another day. I did hang in a bit better, and I have got myself well enough to be able to cope with an interview like this. Because there's no way that I would have been fit enough, well enough. I'm not educated. I'm not, you know, I haven't got all the fancy words to make it work and so it flows in a nice, even package. It's not all thought through. I said to you, when you come in and said hello to me earlier at the dressing room, I didn't say to you, you know, what's the list of questions? I want to know this. I said nothing. You know, you asked me what you want. And I didn't think, you know, and I felt comfortable enough with you. Midway, if the fact that you've gone the way you have, that's fine. And that's good. Because it's... The process I'm feeling is that I'm going through the feeling as it's happening now.
And do you think...
And because I'm well enough to be able to deal with it, because I've every reason to hold my head up high. I've no reason for all those years when I walked around with a baseball cap on my head, hiding from people and terrified
Did
of
you?
Life.
Yeah. You were hiding from people?
Yeah, because I was terrified of what people thought, of what, you know, well, why would they believe anything else when they've only been told one thing? They've only been given one side of the story. And not actually the correct side, or never done in the correct
way. How long did you hide from people, Michael?
And using the father to come at me. When I met the father, his father, of course he's upset. The guy died here. 31-year-old guy lost his life, you know?
How long did you hide for?
7-8 years.
Do you think of the contrast. Think of the contrast of a man that's put himself on stage for all of his life, lives on the stage, and then he's hiding.
Mm. So the very thing that makes me work is not there. So I like, you know...
Are you going to fight the press now? Are you going to take them on?
Yeah.
In what way?
I've got... we've got the apology coming from the News of the World. That'll deal with that side. There's another case, for legal reasons.
Sure.
I've got two other cases that have been dealt with at the moment. In a positive way, for once. And again, at the beginning, like 2 years ago, when the cases started, the lawyer said to me, are you sure you want to take this on because you're going to have a lot to deal with? I said, I've absolutely nothing to lose. It's like tonight. Whatever people's perception is, however... It doesn't sound right to say how well you deal with something, or because I didn't know we were going to go this heavy down this road. I'll be honest, I didn't, and I'm fine with it. I have nothing to lose, because everything's gone anyway.